she'll be able to claim the honour of that record. And of course, the mists of time we look back into when we come to thinking about how Queen Elizabeth II actually came to the throne.
This is London. It is with the greatest sorrow that we make the following announcement. At 10:45 today, February the 6th, 1952, the King passed peacefully away in his sleep earlier this morning.
And eventually, of course, Her Majesty would be crowned the Queen. And that coronation ceremony was carried by Pathé News.
A special significance is attached to each piece of regalia. The jewelled sword of state is presented to the Queen by the Archbishop, who bids her use it for the punishment of evildoers and for the protection of the law-abiding. Her Majesty moves to the altar to offer the sword, signifying that the crown places it at the disposal of the church. Upon the Queen's wrists are placed the armils, bracelets which symbolize the bond which unites her with her people. Now the robe royal is put upon the Queen with the words, "The Lord clothe you with the robe of righteousness and with the garments of salvation." The orb of gold, signifying the dominion of the cross over the world. Viscount Woolton, as Chancellor of the Duchy of Lancaster, offers the glove, symbolizing gentleness in levying taxes. Now the royal scepter, the ensign of kingly power and justice. The rod with the dove, signifying that equity and mercy are never to be forgotten. Now follows the supreme climax of the ancient ritual. With St. Edward's crown, the crown of England, the Archbishop performs the simple yet the most significant ceremony of the Queen's coronation.
And on goes the crown. And that crown has been with Her Majesty the Queen ever since. Let me speak to historian Eamon Phoenix. Eamon, good morning.
Good morning, Frank.
Eamon, you'd need all day, wouldn't you? It's some commentary.
Absolutely, Frank. I mean, it is a moment of history, of course. The longest reigning monarch in British history. We're talking yesterday about Queen Victoria, you know, as a sort of comparison with the present Queen. And we think of the unlikelihood that she would ever succeed to the crown when she was born in 1926, because, of course, she became Queen because her father inherited on the abdication of his brother, you know, the former Edward VIII, who stood down because of a divorce affair in the 1930s with an American lady. And no one would have expected in the 1920s or early 30s that, you know, Elizabeth would have become Queen at all. And so we're looking back on these 63, going on 64 years when she presided over 12 prime ministers of every political hue, 12 American presidents, I think 7 popes. All the changes, of course, to she emerged. She was born at the end of one World War, and she saw, of course, another in which she was drafted into the ancillary services as a driver towards the end of the war. She had that unstructured education, a mixture of kind of tutors and indeed visits to art galleries, an induction into constitutional history. But she was still very young when she was forced to ascend the throne in 1952, only 5 years married. Her father had died before his time, and suddenly you had this young queen. And there was a lot of criticism, I mean, from the great and the good in the 1950s. People forget this, but Lord Altrincham, who was a major conservative, talked about her speaking like a priggish schoolgirl after her coronation. But of course, she soon overcame all that. And I suppose her biggest challenge in those years was really the end of empire. The British Empire was coming to an end. The sun had been setting on it really since the First World War. India had gone in 1947. And she saw all the African colonies or the Caribbean colonies become mainly republics in this period. And it really dawned to her really in her 20s and 30s, that we have the whole concept of the Commonwealth, something that she built up. She became the symbol of this kind of comity of perhaps 62 or 63 different kind of states throughout the globe, which regard her as their head of state. That was certainly a major achievement for a young queen. And as the introduction suggested, she was also the first queen, of course, to have to engage with the electronic media in a massive way. I mean, her coronation was viewed by millions on television, the new invention of the 1950s. And she suddenly became aware that, you know, the royals were being watched. She was being watched, you know, very critically by the mass media. And she found that all the old institutions were taking a battering by the 1960s. You know, Parliament, the Church, that would intensify for both those institutions. And of course, whereas the idea of a royal marrying a divorcee in the 1930s had caused major scandal and abdication, she, of course, would see her sister, Princess Margaret, married and divorced in the 1960s, and three of her own children married and divorced. And she had to deal with all that. And, of course, you had the whole tragedy of Charles and Diana, her famous remarks at the Guildhall banquet in 1992, when she looked back on a year and said it was an annus horribilis, you know, a year of horror, you know. And that, I think, you know, resonated with a lot of sympathy in the general population, because, as you'll remember, after Diana's tragic death, there was a kind of a royal hesitation in embracing the kind of mass mourning on the streets of London at the end of that summer of 1997. And then suddenly the royal family, led by the Queen, took their place. And for a moment it looked as though the monarchy was wobbling in public estimation in Britain. But that was overcome as well. And when we look back on those years, I mean, Britain is a constitutional monarchy, evolving through time from the 17th century on. In many ways, the role of Elizabeth II has strengthened that constitutional monarchy. Her own ethic of public duty, she's faultlessly carried out her role there. She has never acted against advice, as far as we know. Even in the early 1960s, she agreed to the nomination of Sir Alec Douglas Hume as Prime Minister, which kind of went against the grain at the time. He had been in the House of Lords and would eventually have to seek a seat in the House of Commons, and so on. And of course, she played her role as the head of the Church of England, which was, from Henry VIII's time, a key role of the monarchy as well, always, of course, introducing an element of Christianity into her annual Christian messages in an age which, you know, has kind of largely in secular terms abandoned that. And we heard that this morning in various retrospects on the whole thing. And I think we have to regard her as someone who has helped to cement the new relationship between the island of Ireland and Great Britain, and indeed the British political establishment. I mean, I think we all remember her stunning visit to the Republic in 2011, you know, when a sort of a royal visit that had been long considered, but considered to be out of bounds because of the troubles, because of old animosities and so on. But under the aegis of Mary McAleese in 2011, it became possible. Elizabeth visited Dublin, and famously, of course, she paid tribute to the men who had fought for Irish independence at the Garden of Remembrance in Dublin, which was a major step forward. You know, these were people who were regarded as traitors to the British Crown in 1916, in the days of her grandfather, and whose leaders had been executed. And she also, of course, helped nationalist Ireland embrace the 40,000 Irish men from north and south who died in the Great War of 1914-18, when she led the commemoration at the garden, at the Island Bridge Memorial Gardens in Dublin, where there's that monument erected after partition to the Irish men who died in the Great War. There was her famous speech, of course, in Dublin Castle, when she spoke initially as Gaeilge, you know, greeting the audience as a Hardja, my friends, you know, and then going on to really reflect on, you know, Britain's checkered involvement in Ireland. Now, there had been speculation that the monarch might issue some kind of apology for past British misrule, from Cromwell to the famine. That was never really going to happen. But she talked about the resultant legacy of heartache, turbulence and loss. She talked about her own loss hinting at Lord Mountbatten in particular. And she said there were things that might not have been done in the past and could have been done better. And, of course, this won plaudits, I think, from all parts of Ireland at the time, and has really recast the relationship between independent Ireland, the Republic of today, and indeed Great Britain. And, of course, you had the return visit 2 years ago, last year rather, of President Michael Higgins to Windsor, and the first official Irish state visit to Britain. So, I mean, she's associated with all those things.
It's interesting you mentioned the hesitancy at the time of the public mourning following the death of Lady Diana and or Princess Diana, and there was a sense then that the Queen was at her lowest ebb in terms of popularity. And then in recent times, of course, she came to Dublin, and there was a hesitancy in Republican circles, particularly from Sinn Féin. It almost mirrored that hesitancy that the Queen had when Princess Diana died, and Republicans were playing catch-up, and have played catch-up in a very big way with Her Majesty since that. And you still look at those pictures of, you know, a variety of people within Sinn Féin meeting and greeting Her Majesty.
Indeed. Well, I mean, you had that sort of very, very pointed hesitancy over the Diana funeral, you know, which, you know, undermined briefly, as it turned out, because of the Queen's own personality and all of this, and the duty of service. But it did briefly undermine the popularity of the monarchy until the royal family caught up, as it were. In the case of Sinn Féin, it was much the same. I think the Sinn Féin leadership in 2011 underestimated the sea change which had occurred, particularly in the south, towards monarchy. There was always that phrase that historians have used, that there was a sneaking regard for royalty in Southern Ireland always. When there was a royal wedding or a royal event, people would secretly watch the BBC on their televisions. I'm sorry, I'm mentioning another channel. But, you know, and I think Gerry Adams and Martin McGuinness were sort of caught off guard when they boycotted the event. And there were the, you know, present that day was Peter Robinson, was the great Irish poet Seamus Heaney in the last year of his life. It was a marvellous occasion for the whole island. I think they realised that they'd missed out. One gentleman who was the mayor of Clonmel, if you remember, a Sinn Féin mayor, actually greeted the Queen at the Rock of Cashel on her way to the English market in Cork, and he actually caught the mood much better. But very, very different, of course, in 2013 when she visited Northern Ireland, and of course Martin McGuinness stood alongside Peter Robinson in the Lyric Theatre to extend the hand of friendship. And you saw the warmth of the royal handshake on that occasion. Martin McGuinness then attending, of course, the royal banquet last year for Michael Higgins in Windsor. So, I mean, in many ways, nationalist Ireland is moving on. I sometimes wonder to what extent in the north, you know, all sections of the community realise the sea change. When I was in Dublin on Saturday with a mixed group of people from both sections of the community who visited Kilmainham Jail and the First World War Gardens at Island Bridge. And, you know, there, the beauty of Island Bridge, you know, and in many ways, the men who died in the Great War, the men who died in the 1916 Rising from different traditions, different causes, are all remembered now in Dublin, in Southern Ireland. And that's partly and largely perhaps as a result of Queen Elizabeth's visit there in 2011.
As a historian, how surprised were you when she bowed her head in the Garden of Remembrance?
Well, I know it was carefully nuanced. It was interesting that she didn't go to Arbour Hill, which is the main place of pilgrimage for Republican Ireland, where the 1916 leaders, Pearse and Connolly, are actually buried. She didn't go there. That might have been a bridge too far in a sense, and it might have resulted in some criticism from perhaps nationalist Republican circles. But she went to the Garden of Remembrance, where the 1916 leaders had been corralled after the surrender, before they were taken off for court-martial and execution. It's a very resonant place for Irish nationalism in the last 100 years. And yet there was a symbolism, because the great kind of monument there by Oisin Kelly shows, of course, the broken swords. The swords after the battle have been broken, symbolising new beginnings. And I think, you know, her visit chimed with that. And that was carefully researched and carefully choreographed. And she played her role, you know, splendidly, you know, as she has done in Britain. as a kind of a symbol of the people of Great Britain, you know. And she realised that this was Ireland, which had been part of the patrimony of her grandfather George V, who had done a lot to encourage peace in Ireland during and after the First World War, and of course her great grandmother Queen Victoria, who had a less easy relationship with Ireland, the famine, home rule and all of that. She was never a fan of Irish nationalism, Victoria. But the present Queen is aware that she heads up a multiracial, multicultural Commonwealth, and she's aware of the importance of Anglo-Irish relations. These countries, which have always been, if you like intimate strangers, are now becoming intimate friends, and her visit played a key part in that.
Looking to the future, there are people who would like to do away with the monarchy, who would like an elected head of state, as opposed to it being handed down through the generations. 100 years from now, 200 years from now, will there still be a monarchy as the head of state in Britain?
Well, you know, the last 200 years have seen two world wars and many others and many changes. The great crowned heads of Europe have rolled from 1918 on. But I think a lot depends on the personality of the monarch, and the monarch accepting her role as a constitutional figurehead, his role perhaps, in the future. And I think she has always been very careful to, you know, realise and accept that power rests at Westminster, you know, with the representatives of the people. And she's there as a kind of an ambassador and indeed a unifying force in times of turmoil and challenge. And I think, you know, a monarchy will survive in Britain as long as that is the outlook of the monarch. In many ways, today, for example, Elizabeth will be on the same train as Nicola Sturgeon, the Scottish First Minister, opening up the new Borders Railway. Now, Scotland is a country which both of these ladies love, but they have very, very different visions for Scotland's future. And yet she realises the importance of being there, the palace at Balmoral, the close links with the Heather. Yet she knows Nicola Sturgeon is a Scottish separatist whose colours are pinned to that mast. Yet I think everyone feels that that will be a civil conversation for 2 hours on a train in Scotland today. And when Queen Elizabeth emerges from the train, you know, for the foreseeable future, somehow the union with Scotland will seem a bit stronger because of that gesture. You know, it's her sense of timing, her sense of duty in Britain, and indeed her adroitness in handling complex and controversial issues.
Eamon, it's always great to listen
Absolutely,
to you.
Frank, can I just do my usual plug for my lifelong learning?
Please do,
Indeed, I mean, Stranmillers University College is just about to embark on another year of this exciting lifelong learning program. We have classes from 10 in the morning to 10 at night in all areas, history, health and leisure. We have history courses, the Big House in Ireland, Ireland and the Cold War. We have the history of art. We have a seminar by the very eminent retired heart surgeon, Dr. Gianfranco Campolani, on the existence of God coming up on a Saturday in November. We have courses in languages. We have a course on Parnell and the poets of the 1916 Rising. If people are interested in joining, and we have of course our famous walking tours when we explore the history of different parts of Belfast over 10 mornings. If anybody's interested, they simply have to look up our website, www.strand.ac.uk, or ring Stranmillers Lifelong Learning, and they will discover our courses.
Eamon, it's always a pleasure. Thanks for your time.
Bye.
Thank you. Eamon Phoenix, a historian extraordinaire.